and the power of one button that was challenging to all of us this morning. I hope that you'll reflect on several of those images as we walk through the next couple of chapters in 1 Corinthians and think about the power that we all have as we are in our different roles every day. Really, today is one of those universal lessons about setting a good example and about being a good role model and wearing the jersey and remembering all that you need to remember when you're in that jersey. I kind of look at it as one of the iconic mom sermons, too, you know, that you equip your children with when you start out, remember to be a good example. As a coach, and I coached drill team for a while early in my teaching career, and I remember telling the girls that when, regardless of whether you're in uniform or out of uniform, you are a Silverado. You are a member of the drill team. So your actions and your words and your habits are being watched. And it's not, all of those things aren't just going to be reflecting upon you as an individual gal, but you're going to have an effect upon the whole team, the whole dance line. And so this is one of those times. It's also, I think, I was like, man, why didn't I refer to this? Because I just launched one to college this fall. And I was like, yeah, be a good role model. Remember where the jersey, you know, how, remember what you're supposed to do. So any of you all out there, I'm giving you, you know, kind of that ready-made tab on your file folder that you can use as well. But Paul addresses a topic today that on the surface, maybe you wouldn't first glance and think, well, this would be a lesson about being a good role model or being about a good example, because it comes in by the way of food, leftovers, something that challenges all of us. What do you do with them? Is it Tupperware? Is it a Ziploc? How long are they going to be in the refrigerator? Do I make a new creation? Kind of a shelf surprise on Friday from Monday through Thursday. You know, what do you do with them? It is a question. It is a challenge. I remember chuckling in my refrigerator. My mom was always a wizard of being able to just save and then recreate and recycle before it was even cool. And so in our refrigerator, our leftovers, and we ate leftovers. My husband is not a fan of leftovers. I eat leftovers. And so in our refrigerator going up, though, I'd see like a butter tub, I'd see a Cool Whip container, I'd see a Tupperware container, whatever. And just because of what it was labeled on the outside did not guarantee the contents on the inside, right? Sometimes you would pull out the butter tub and be ready to put that on your toast and you're looking at roast. You know, other times you would pull out the Cool Whip thinking, oh, you know, this is going to be great to put on the top of something. You're like, ooh, what is that? You know? So anyway, the new Christians in Corinth were, you know, struggling with needing a laundry list out of Paul of what we do. You know, they're coming from a pagan situation where there were a lot of practices and idol worship and just day-to-day practices now that are totally being transformed. And there's not really a guidebook. The internal moral compass is still developing. The term that we'll see that's used in the text is weak. It means it's just not mature yet. And a lot of times those folks were finding that they were looking first at their brothers and sisters for guidance instead of their WWJD rubber bracelet. Okay? Which many times people in our midst today as well do the same thing, contingent upon where they are in their development as well. So we're going to be looking at the power of one love surrounding one God, the impact of one decision, one sacrifice upon everyone's life. And so you have to understand that we had several factions of people at this time. We had the Gentiles. We had the folks that were still struggling with remnants of a past life, still trying to shake some of those habits. You also needed to understand where they got their meat. There, you know, they didn't have the luxury of having to choose between H-E-B or Randall's or Cooper's or in Houston, the Rice Epicurean Market. They didn't have all of those options. Couldn't go to Rudy's Barbecue, couldn't go to County Line. You know, they either got their meat from the market Or for a cheaper bargain price, you could go and get the remnants from the sacrifice at the temple. And that's after the priest had kept whatever he wanted to keep from that. You also have to understand different mindsets of the people when it came to meat that had been sacrificed. You had some that clearly owned and just really believed that pagan spirits were real and could enter the body through food. They could actually be absorbed into the food. You also had a belief that, you know, from a group of people that, you know what, I believe in evil spirits, but they're not getting in me through my food. So I'm not going to worry about that. And then you had people that were very firm, a little bit more seasoned, a little bit more mature, who said, that's hooey. You know, there's no such thing as all that. That idol is just a block of wood or a piece of stone over there. And this meat is completely fine. Because anything that was intended to be sacrificed to something that doesn't exist is okay. They could logically explain that away. But this was bringing potential division in the church. So that's why they wrote Paul and said, help. We've got a problem here. How can you help us work this out? Well, Paul is not going to give them the answer that they're wanting. I know you're shocked by that. And it's going to continue to frustrate them. Now, for those of you who are my GT students in here and have already read ahead in chapter 10, you will see that he finally has to spell it out. Yes, you can do this with this time. No, you can't do it with this. And hopefully now I'm motivating you to go ahead and start reading for the lecture for chapter 10. But right now, he doesn't want to focus on the food. He doesn't want to give them a rule to look at on food, because that's not what Paul is about. He doesn't want them to start climbing that very slippery slope of legalism, which is what's going to happen when a weaker believer and it has a weaker or underdeveloped, or as we say, emerging moral compass. You want to have those rules, and you want them to be universally applicable to every situation. You want answers in those gray areas of life where there's not a 12th, a 13th, a 14th commandment written about them. So let's look at the passage together, if you have your lesson or in your Bible, 1 Corinthians 8, verses 1 through 13. Now, concerning food offered to the idols, we know that all of us possess knowledge. This knowledge, and note there the use of quotation marks. I want you to look at the different phrases that are encased in quotation marks, ladies, because he's actually extracting exact language from the letter that they wrote to him. So he's giving them back in their terms his quote answer. This knowledge puffs up, but love builds up. If anyone imagines that he knows something, he does not yet know as he ought to know. But if anyone loves God, he is known by God. Therefore, as to the eating of food offered to idols, we know that an idol has no real existence, and that there is no God but one. For although there may be so-called gods in heaven or on earth, as indeed there are many gods and many lords, yet for us, there is one God, the Father, from whom all things and for whom we exist, and one Lord, Jesus Christ, through whom all things and through whom we exist. However, not all possess this knowledge, but some, through former association with idols, eat food as really offered to an idol, and their conscience, being weak, is defiled. Food will not commend us to God. We are no worse off if we do not eat, and no better off if we do. But take care that this right of yours does not somehow become a stumbling block to the weak. For if anyone sees you have knowledge eating in an idol's temple, he will not be encouraged. If his conscience is weak to eat food offered to idols, and so by your knowledge, this weak person is destroyed, the brother for whom Christ died, thus sinning against your brothers and wounding their conscience, When it is weak, you sin against Christ. Therefore, if food makes my brother stumble, I will never eat meat lest I make my brother stumble. I wanted to read that out loud because when you have to say that something you do against someone else is a sin against Christ, it's pretty powerful. Makes a difference to have to say it as well as to have to hear it. And so I wanted us to have that experience together. Now, I think, too, that he is telling them knowledge is a good thing, but it needs to be balanced by love. You need to be more concerned about the relationships here than about what you know of a certain practice. You need to prioritize your brothers and sisters, regardless of if they know as much as you do, because some of them don't. You need to know your friends. You need to respect your friends. You need to value their heart and their emerging spiritual development more than your knowledge. I mean, think about it. There are a lot of areas in our lives where maybe we have a lot of knowledge about, but maybe somebody else doesn't. But that doesn't mean that we should be puffed up and talk down to them or not invite them into a conversation because, quote, they aren't at our level or they just don't understand. Or, you know, I garden to this extent or I cook, you know, to this level and they don't. Or maybe I work at the Capitol, so they wouldn't know about all the politics that I do. Or, you know, I have a law degree, and so, you know, I'm not going to talk to them about those things. Or whatever your hobby or your interest or your professional capacity, you know, is. Paul is saying you need to mutually respect one another, that we all are coming to this place of understanding about salvation, understanding about one God, understanding about one love. We're all at a different place, but that's okay. We need to love one another and balance our knowledge with that love. Think about some of those gray moral areas where there isn't a 12th commandment. We all know that it's nothing wrong in letting children go trick-or-treat, but what about your friends that don't observe Halloween or have strong convictions against Halloween? What happens? How do you handle that? Or you know that playing Texas Hold'em with your family members on your annual camping trip is just innocent fun. But how do you respond to the wife of your uncle who's battling a gambling addiction and ask that you skip that family tradition this year? What else do you know about social drinking, social media, Instagram, Facebook? What about washing your car or shopping on Sundays, watching R-rated movies? And how do you respond to a Christian brother or sister who has different convictions about all of those areas than you do? Does that mean that we don't hang out with them anymore? Does that mean that we judge them, as we've already been told in previous chapters, not to do? That they're anyway less than or that I'm doing it wrong? Hey, look, I can tell you, I had some fabulous Halloween costumes growing up. Okay? I was a witch. I was Raggedy Ann. I was a baby. I've had children, you know, that I'm raising, that I have raised, that we've done some really fun things. We've been Power Rangers. We've been superheroes. We've been Disney princesses. I mean, we've run the gamut. And I know that my children don't worship Satan. And I know that in my house, I have a knowledge that I can balance and I can be a Christian wife and mother and have a family that is surrounded in love and participate in Halloween with my children. But I have friends and neighbors that don't. And I love them. And we know that we have differing opinions. And I have friends who are recovering alcoholics. And I know when I invite them to my home, I am not, out of respect for them, going to serve alcohol. I'm not going to partake alcohol in front of them. I have others that have had alcoholics in their family. Maybe they aren't wrestling with that personally, but I know that that is a deep struggle for them. There are all types of these gray areas where there is not an ironclad commandment. And Paul here is saying, I'm not going to give you a rule about tainted meat, so that your focus is going to be on meat versus the heart of your brother or sister. We're going to work this out together without going to that extreme. So the issue isn't about someone thinking less of us because of what they see us doing. It's about someone thinking less of Christ because they're following our example. So that's where we have to be aware of the power of one love around one God. And we are all one person that can be that one example to someone else. And we need to prioritize our friends and our brothers and sisters over whatever the behavior, the holiday, the situation, the addiction, the problem, the gray area. We need to love that person first before we say anything, before we do anything. It's all about decisions, and it's all about making decisions that benefit the greater good versus just thinking about ourselves, right? And it goes back to that universal lesson about being that good example and about being that good role model and about remember who you are in that jersey as well as who you are when you're not in that jersey. And this is not the first time that Paul has reminded us about our witness to other people. Chapter 1, consider your calling. We are holy. Chapter 3, by the grace of God, each one should build with care. Chapter 3, you're God's temple, you're of Christ. Chapter 4, we are servants of God and stewards of the mysteries of God. Chapter 5, do not associate with anyone of sexual immorality or greed, or an idolater, or a drunkard, or a swindler. Don't even eat with such a one. Chapter 6, all things are lawful for me, but not all things are helpful or beneficial. Chapter 6, your body is a temple of the Holy Spirit, bought with a price. Chapter 7, do not become bondservants of men. And today, take care that this knowledge of one God and one love of yours does not somehow become a stumbling block to someone who is weaker. We don't need to just look at our freedom, but we need to look at our brothers and sisters' needs. If somebody else could be hurt spiritually by something we say, something that we do, we need to give that freedom up. We need to sacrifice that activity, that behavior, out of respect and love for him or her. So if eating meat that has been part of an idol sacrifice is going to be offensive to someone, Paul is saying, don't eat it. But he didn't come right out and tell them that. What is he going to do? He is going to give himself as a personal example. So as we move into chapter 9, let's look at the principles in chapter 8 that he's given us. What is safe for one Christian may not be so for another. True discernment always requires love as well as knowledge. And believers do not have the right to demand certain freedoms if they in turn prove detrimental to those around you. So ladies, what kind of food are we eating? What are we eating? What's in our diet? And when faced with decisions in the gray areas, are we prioritizing God's people? Are we looking at who will benefit more, me or them, by that behavior? Am I pursuing God's glory? Does this decision about this moral issue give people a better picture of who God is? Will this decision please God and fulfill his ultimate purpose? And something you might want to do in your small group or in your personal private quiet time is looking at verse 13. Therefore, if food makes my brother stumble, I will never eat meat lest I make my brother stumble. Take out the word food and take out the word meat and put in there maybe an area that recently has caused some issue. Has it potentially been divisive between you and a family member, between you and a neighbor, between you and a carpool mate, between you and a friend, you and a spouse? What is it in your diet that we need to maybe reflect and take out and sacrifice and give up out of love for that other person? So let's look now at chapter 9, where Paul is actually going to use himself and his ministry as a living example of what he has just told them about loving someone more than self, about sacrificing certain freedoms, and as we call them today, rights, because you love that person more. You know, the man who invented the smiley face, his name was Harvey Ball. He created it. He was a graphic artist and an ad guy. He came up with the image in 1963 when he was commissioned to create that smiley face graphic to raise morale among the employees of an insurance company after a series of difficult mergers and acquisitions. He finished the design in less than 10 minutes and was paid $45 for his work. The State Mutual Life Assurance Company, now called All America Financial Corporation, made posters, buttons, signs adorned with that grin in the attempt to get their employees to smile more. It's uncertain whether or not the new logo really boosted their morale, but the smiling face was an immediate hit and the company produced thousands of buttons, and neither Ball or State Mutual tried to trademark or copyright the design. So, today the Smiley Company makes more than $130 million a year and is one of the top 100 licensing companies of the world. After Harvey Ball's death in 2001, his son Charles said in an obituary that his father was never bitter about the very small $45 amount that he earned from the smiley face, and that his dad really never regretted forgoing a copyright, because he considered his greatest achievement not this famous logo, but actually the Bronze Star that he had received for heroism during the Battle of Okinawa. Paul in this chapter is going to tell us and the Corinthians what he desires his greatest accomplishment in life to be. He actually uses his life and work as a personal example, or as I like to call it, Paul is going to give us his resume. He is going to defend his credentials, because contextually you need to know that because Paul was not willing to accept monetary compensation for his work, as we're getting to the tail end of these 18 months here in Corinth, people were starting to wonder, well, if you're not wanting to get paid, dude, are you really authentic? Are you really who you say you are? Who in the world works for free? Because Paul was continuing to be a tent maker and provide for himself. Unlike the cultural practice that you take care of your ministers, you provide maybe housing or food, and if they're married, you also take care and love on their wife and their family. And priests and rabbis, partook of the offerings at the temple. However, with that, there was kind of a side glance every now and then that perhaps some people were taking advantage of their position, just getting fat and happy off the people. And maybe not really, having the performance that they needed to. So in order to kind of squelch all of that, and in order to have, for Paul not to have anything that would be a stumbling block to his life work, anything that would cause his brother to stumble, so that people wouldn't look at him and say, oh, you're taking advantage that you're an apostle. Or, you know what, you have too much access to all that meat all the time. Or, you get to stay with that person because they just have the nicest house. And are you too good? You can't stay on our street, too? Well, so what I've done is I wanted to share with you Paul's resume. His credentials that he puts out there to justify what he's doing. So basically, chapter 9 is Paul's resume. And you can see up here, you have to go almost to the end of the chapter to look at what his career objective is. Now, I have been in the resume world recently myself because I am reentering the workforce. And so I have been very honed in on credentials, education, going through interviews, having to prove yourself, being judged. Somebody like me, somebody take a risk on me. Yes, I can do that. Oh, no, I don't know if I can do that. All of this thing. So I said, that's what Paul is. Paul is putting out his resume of credentials. So his career objective here is he, a disciple of Christ, desires to be a servant to all in order to share the blessings of the gospel and receive the prize of salvation. That is the employment that he is seeking. What's his degree? He's an apostle. To be an apostle, you had to have had a personal encounter with Jesus Christ, most likely seen the resurrection. Check. Okay. Work and leadership experience. Well, he tells us in these verses and compares himself to a soldier on a battlefield. Who does he battle? Satan. A farmer who is, you know, has a vineyard, a shepherd who tends sheep. Let's see, preacher, soul winner, tent maker, leather craftsman, disciple, apostle, et cetera, et cetera. His salary history, he even quotes the old law in Deuteronomy that is the same wording that he shares about the oxen here in 1 Corinthians. You shall not muzzle an ox while it treads out the grain. In other words, historically, people take care of their pastors. People take care of their ministers. And then because he was talking to those people in his audience that knew that old law, the Jewish converts that needed to hear. Then also 1 Corinthians 9, 8 through 14, those of you all who are employed by the temple receive food and sacrificial offerings. So for those of you who are Gentiles, here is something for you. So I've justified myself to both groups. Salary expectations, I'll do it for free. I'll do it for free. Because you know why? I was called to do this. So I feel like I am a steward of this job. I didn't go seeking to do this. God called me, so I'm just fulfilling my responsibility. I don't want to take money. I don't want to take money for that. I'm just doing what I was called to do. So thank you very much. References, well, I've got God and I've got Jesus. And letters of recommendation, well, you have them, okay? Because the guy has obviously written a lot of recommendations to this group of people. And, of course, I think there were quite a you know, obviously the people there in Corinth were the seal of his work. We're told that. They were the living proof. His work product was right there, and he was among them. So he is using his life, his resume, as an example of complete sacrifice for those that he loves. Did he have knowledge? Did he know more than a lot of these people? You better bet. Could we have probably listed out a lot of degrees, a lot of ABCs and XYZs after his name? Sure. Absolutely. But was he going to use his position and his knowledge to puff up? Or was he going to use the love that he had for his fellow man to build up? So the guy's pretty savvy, all right? He appeals to logic. He appeals to the old law. He appeals to the new law. He knows his audience. He respects every single group. He is all-inclusive, not exclusive. And he still is not telling them, do this on this day with meat. Because that's not the point. So here they thought they were going to get advice on what to do with the leftovers. And Paul was like, no, I'm going to show you how to take that and make a new creation. How to be like mom and do the chef's surprise on Friday with what she made on Monday. So he gave up his right to a wife, a soldier who gave up his right to a salary, a vineyard worker who gave up his right to eat his grapes, to drink the sheep's milk, to eat grain, a harvest, food, a preacher who gave up his right to an offering. With freedom of the gospel comes responsibility. Rewards are not without sacrifice. Are we running the race well? Because quickly, because I'm going to give you the opportunity in your small groups to really drill down. That final section, verses 23 through 27, is awesome. And that's part of why I chose the video that we opened with, because you saw that race, that runner who pushed through to cross that finish line, to finish that race, to take all of her training, all of her sacrifice, all of her self-discipline, and win. And so that is also why at the very end, when Paul has outlined for everybody as a living example what he is meaning, prioritize relationships over meat. Love one another despite of your varying levels of knowledge. Then he uses the athletic metaphor of a runner preparing for a race. All of us have friends, or maybe I'm in the midst of some very physically driven people who run the dance skin, who do the Iron Woman, the Iron Man. You know, I see all these boot camps, I see all of these people that are just committed. They have decided, I'm going to train my body because I have a goal. I have a prize. I want to either win, or I just have it on my bucket list before I turn a certain age that is an accomplishment that I would like to achieve. And from what I understand, the discipline that is required is just over the top. And it does require a lot of sacrifice. I know this week, I have justified my sacrifice of laundry and sacrifice of picking up the house and everything because I'm furthering the kingdom this week, kids, okay? Little doggies, I know I have to get your food, but you may not get walked as much because I'm in the Word, I am doing this for the glory of Jesus. And so that has been my week, kind of justification for not tending to my other callings. But I'm fine with that. I really have been totally fine with all of that. Not to say that I would ever do this full time, but it's okay. He uses that athletic metaphor again too, because every couple of years they would have not the Olympics, but something called the Isthmian Games. And everybody in his audience was very familiar with the athletes that actually had to sign a contract that for 10 months they were going to be self-disciplined and follow a stringent diet. And if it was discovered that they had varied from that contract or they had broken that contract, then they would be, quote, disqualified. And so that's why Paul at the very end says, here I have been everything to everybody. I've tried to be, sympathetic and respectful of all these different groups. But at the end of the day, I want to make sure that I have run the race well. I have run the race well, and I have not been disqualified. And you have to understand the context and meaning of disqualified there is not like he's not going to get in heaven, okay? Disqualified there is disapproved. I want to run and be approved for my work. So how does our life's resume read? What's our life's career objective? What is our salary expectation? How many of us have always wrestled, well, if you had to pay me for every sock I wash, every meal, the schlepping of the groceries, all of that. What kind of impact, though, are you having with your career, with your life, your calling? Remember in our video with the ripple of water that goes out, those concentric circles? The impact of just that one touch into the water. What kind of impact are you having on your brothers and sisters? They're watching. They're listening. Some of them don't know as much as we know. And in the spirit of Halloween, this weekend, Hi and Lois loves this. I was like, oh, my gosh. And actually, my husband, who just reads the paper, he just reads all day long in his job. And I can't understand why he just, reads all, the stuff. But he was reading this weekend and came and said, oh, my gosh, I think this is great. I think this might work with your lesson. I was like, okay, well, let me see. And I'm like, a comic? Okay. But it really did. They are deciding what they want to be for Halloween. Time to decide what you want to be. Well, I want to be a princess. Well, I want to be a pirate. Well, what do you want to be, little Trixie? Well, I haven't really given it much thought. So then she starts thinking. She thinks of a queen or a witch or a cat or a clown or a devil or a monster. And finally she just says, I think I just want to be me for Halloween. A lot of power in little Trixie. I just want to be me. Who are we going to be? Are we going to be that grain of sand? That single spark, that simple dream, that gentle word, that one act of love that can start a chain reaction. Who are we going to be? Now, We are completely out of time, and we are completely without a piano player today. And so originally I had designed a very simple chorus, and maybe in your small group to close your prayer, you all could just do one of these choruses with that little light of mine. Because on our hands we have two reminders of who's in charge and the power of one, right? And when you do the five-finger prayer, you know, each finger represents something. The thumb are those that are nearest and dearest to us. The index finger are the people that have authority over us. The middle people are the people who stand tall among us, our leaders. The ring finger, those that are weak. And the pinky, putting yourself last. And also remembering the little folks in our life. So, you know, those are two prayers that you have on you all the time. But looking at the purpose of that index finger, remind yourself when you see those fingers, the power of one, it can be this kind of impact. It can be this kind of impact. It can be that kind of impact. Bless you. Go forth. Have a wonderful lesson.